Chapter 36, Fear. One of the defining characteristics of autism, as Connor and Asperger witnessed it, was the age at which their patients began to show issues. Before the 1930s, it was rare to see children born apparently without problems, only to develop acute neurological issues later on. Some of the parents believed their children to be different from a very early age, while others noted an explicit regression later on. Whatever the timing, the onset of autism as we now define it typically occurs between the ages of 12 and 18 months. For infants, the administration of vaccines is fairly easy. Most babies may be unaware of what's happening to them, may not have the memories of previous doctor visits, and certainly don't have the strength to resist any medical procedure being forced upon them. In the arms of their mother or father, it wouldn't matter if they were in a pit infested with snakes and crocodiles. They would have absolutely no awareness that something horrible might happen. At that point in early life, nurses can inject babies with little effort. They may react with tears and crying to the pain of the injection, but usually after the fact. As infants grow up, they learn to recognize danger. Their eyes are able to more easily focus. They can identify familiar and unfamiliar faces. And they can certainly begin to develop patterns of recognition from previous experiences that alert them to potential threats. This process is a natural part of growing up and will help protect them from harm as they venture from their mother's bosom and gain independence. When toddlers need to be vaccinated, what was a routine procedure for when they were infants can feel like protracted battles of life and death. For parents and their healthcare practitioners, there may be less concern. They believe the pain of being injected with a foreign substance to be worth the promise of protection it offers. The children on the receiving end, however, will not understand this. There is a primordial fear of receiving the deep puncture of a needle that's difficult to overcome, even for many adults. For toddlers who may have already received several painful injections just months earlier, the instinct to escape will be strong. It's not uncommon to hear of nurses chasing a frightened toddler down the hall or even plucking them from the bushes outside. So intense was the child's fear. Once corralled inside, it might take the efforts of several nurses and a parent to secure the child firmly enough to prevent a needle from breaking off inside their body. Bruno Bettelheim, who is the world's most famous proponent of poor parenting as a cause for autism, would allude to this, although he was unaware of its significance. Quote, "A final paradox is that while autistic children do not seem to feel pain, their fear of it generates near superhuman strength. I cite again the frail girl who did not react to the normally unbearable pain of being examined with a ruptured appendix. Later on, when physically well, she had to be held by two adults when an injection became necessary. Thus, external intrusion must seem vastly more dangerous to these children than anything that comes from within." End quote. This primordial fear of needles generally tapers off as children grow up. They may begin to understand the reasoning behind them, if only partially, or many times a parent can promise them a reward in exchange for their cooperation. For infants, these deliberations are unnecessary. For 12 to 18-month-old toddlers, they're often impossible. If this is the case, physical force may be required, usually in the form of immobilization or restraint. The initial response to fear is known by a commonly used term, fight or flight. When someone encounters a potential threat, their body chemistry begins to change. Their heart rate increases, blood pressure rises, and muscles are prepared for action by a complex sequence of hormonal changes. Resources are reallocated within the body, which trigger a suppression of the immune system and digestive function, an effect which causes the intestinal problems one typically associates with anxiety. According to proponents of polyvagal theory, during times of extreme stress, when the fight-or-flight response appears to no longer be an option, the body transitions into another phase. This second stage, referred to as death feigning, occurs as, quote, "an adaptive response to life threat when options for fight-or-flight behaviors are minimized, such as during restraint or when there is an inability to escape," end quote. This is not a voluntary response, but a reflexive reaction to what appears to be imminent harm. Possums clearly exhibit this phenomenon with a behavior we call playing dead. The animal is not consciously pretending to be dead, holding its breath, closing its eyes, or any other attempt to fool. It has gone catatonic, the involuntary result of its transition into feigning death. It will eventually wake up, but not at a time when it feels safe to do so, when the body chemistry that was aggressively manipulated is restored to normal. It will awake, ideally without having been harmed. While humans rarely exhibit the complete body shutdown of death feigning, dramatic changes to body chemistry do occur. Unfortunately, it is suspected that these changes create an aggressive signal for help from the brain. Just as it happens with tissue injury or pathogen invasion, intense fear appears capable of causing the brain to signal for white blood cells to come to its aid, a proactive request made all the more intense as options for fight or flight evaporate. More study is needed to confirm this hypothesis, but the facts appear to support it. Infants, older children, and adults seem less frequently affected by neurological problems after vaccination. Even military personnel, who probably receive more routine immunizations than anyone, do not frequently suffer the neurological effects of vaccination, at least not immediately. Toddlers, however, the very children for whom restraint and immobilization is frequently required to administer vaccines, they are the ones who seem to suffer the most acutely. Previous medical procedures would have necessitated immobilization and restraint. Dragging a multi-bladed scarificator down someone's arm in order to drain a pint of blood was not something any child would willingly submit to. Scalding a toddler's back with acidic pastes or burning hot glass to draw out the polio would have also taken physical force to administer. But until 1932, children had never experienced the injection of a metallic compound, a procedure which would have simultaneously filled their white blood cells with aluminum and their hearts with crippling fear. In so doing, all three components that might trigger signals for help from the brain were simultaneously met: tissue injury, pathogen invasion, and a massive response to stress. The aluminum-precipitated diphtheria, tetanus, and pertussis vaccines they began to receive did contain very little aluminum hydroxide. But unfortunately, when it came to neurological injury, the method by which they were administered was unequaled in making the most of every single microgram. This diabolical hypothesis, if true, serves to explain another trait of autism that has vexed researchers for decades. Why the parents of the earliest children seemed so intelligent and well-heeled, we may never know. Why certain children seem capable of recovery when others, despite the Herculean efforts of those who love them unfailingly, show little improvement, that is another painful riddle we may never untangle. But why autism struck boys so frequently rather than girls? That is a phenomenon whose origins may be crystal clear.